From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is criticizing the appointment of a special counsel to investigate his campaign's possible ties to Russia and Russian election hacking. Trump tweeted this morning, "This is the single greatest witch hunt of a politician in American history." Also today, the entire Senate receives a closed-door briefing from the man who appointed the special counsel. That would be Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. We're joined now by NPR congressional reporter Jeff Bennett. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's start with the news, which was first reported by the Associated Press, that the top Republican on the Senate Intelligence Committee, that would be Senator Burr, says that fired National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's lawyers say he will not honor a subpoena. What more do we know about that?
Well, at the moment, I'll tell you, you know, Burr and Warner, the top Democrat on the committee, have been trying to get more information to continue this investigation. They said they had not heard directly from the White House about other aspects of their investigation. And so they did, you know, subpoena those documents. And so we're waiting to hear directly from Senator Burr about what next steps he might take, if any.
But the AP reporting today that the top Republican says that Flynn's lawyers say that he won't honor a subpoena. So we'll see what happens with that. Meanwhile, in the House Intelligence Committee has requested documents related to the Comey firing from the Justice Department and FBI. And committee leaders want to talk to Trump?
That's the word. Other committees have also requested documents related to this, to their overall investigation. This, of course, all stems from the reporting in the New York Times, first reported by the New York Times, but then also confirmed by NPR, that according to this memo, President Trump suggested or tried to pressure then FBI Director James Comey to end the investigation into the ousted NSA director, National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. So the Oversight Committee has requested these documents. Other committees in the Senate have requested these documents. They've also invited Comey to testify in public. We understand he may not do that now since there has been a special counsel appointed. But there are lawmakers on both sides who say the American public deserves to know at this point what Comey knows.
All right, well, we also learned today that the Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz will step down early from Congress. He heads the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee that you were just talking about. Here he is speaking this morning on NBC about the appointment of a special counsel.
I have not seen evidence of actual collusion. And so it does beg the question, why do they need a special prosecutor? What are they actually trying to prosecute? But the Department of Justice made this case. There are a lot of people that wanted to see it, particularly on the Democratic side of the aisle. And now it's in place. And I think he'll do a good job.
How are lawmakers reacting today to the whole idea of the appointment of a special counsel?
Well, you know, the response has been positive by and large. Democrats and Republicans say Mueller has a reputation for being apolitical, for being independent. And there's a sense that he'll bring a decent measure of integrity to this Russia investigation because Mueller, as you know, served as FBI director from 2001 to 2013. And he took the job a week before 9/11. But this is something that Democrats have been calling for. Chuck Schumer, who leads Senate Democrats, spoke on the Senate floor a few days ago and implored Rod Rosenstein to appoint a special counsel. Now that he's done it, Schumer and other Democrats say they're far more confident that this investigation will follow the facts wherever they might lead. Republicans, I'll tell you, also welcome this news. Folks like Texas Senator John Cornyn say this really turns down the temperature here on Capitol Hill and actually eases the way for the Senate to ultimately confirm a new FBI director. But the other thing that is true, I'll say, is that Republicans are relieved to no longer have to deal with these questions on a daily basis. This gives them some breathing room to move along their agenda, and that they can at least now punt some of these questions they get from us reporters to Bob Mueller and his staff.
Is it true that the White House found out about the special counsel appointment just minutes before it was announced?
We understand that is the case, and frankly, that's how it should be if this investigation is to move forward in an independent nature. But the thing here that folks should know is that, you know, if people think this is going to be wrapped up quickly, they'd be mistaken. This investigation could well take years, although indictments and prosecutions, if they do come at all, could come well in advance of the end of this whole thing. But, you know, the Washington Post took a look at some of the timelines of other special counsel investigations, and they crunched the numbers. And they think that this thing might end sometime in late November 2019. So well after the midterm elections, if folks are wondering what kind of political impact this will have, you know, immediately.
So we'll be talking about this for a while. Well, there's another story on Capitol Hill that I want to get your thoughts on. The Washington Post reported about a recorded conversation that Republican leaders had a year ago about Trump's Russia ties. Last June, House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy told other Republicans he thought Trump was being paid by Vladimir Putin. House Speaker Paul Ryan demanded the conversation be kept secret. Both are calling their comments a joke. Again, this is all according to The Washington Post. But what's going on here?
OK, here's the thing. So you'll remember around the time that this conversation happened that the Republican establishment didn't really take Donald Trump seriously. It was a foregone conclusion that Hillary Clinton would be the next president. So that's the backdrop. The other thing is that Kevin McCarthy is a jovial guy. He's kind of got like a frat boy way about him. He made fun of my necktie once a few years ago. So like that's the kind of guy he is. I could totally see McCarthy cracking a joke like that in private and then someone like Paul Ryan trying to shut it down. Here's the wrinkle, though. The Washington Post approached the House Speaker's office with this story. His press team said, oh, that never happened. The Washington Post then said, well, we have a tape. And then the response was, oh, well, it did happen, but it was a joke. So that's one thing. And then Evan McMullen, who folks might remember, he ran for president last year as an independent, and he's been a Trump critic. He actually wrote about this back in February. He didn't name McCarthy, but the way he wrote about the conversation did not suggest at all that it was a joke. So McCarthy says it was a joke. There's some other reporting out there, and at least McMullen's take on it, that he was not kidding at all. So that's
where we are on that one.
Yeah, that's where we are right now.
NPR congressional reporter Jeff Bennett, thanks as always.
Sure, take care.
Business is booming for legal marijuana, which brought in an estimated $6.6 billion last year and is projected to grow to more than $24 billion by 2025. More than half of states have legalized or decriminalized marijuana, with more than a dozen now taxing cannabis products. But in Alaska, where voters legalized pot in 2014, federal roadblocks and difficult geography are making it tricky for some businesses to pay those state taxes. Jacob Resnick from member station KTOO in Juneau reports.
Paying taxes isn't fun, but it's usually pretty straightforward. Mail a check, set up a direct deposit, easy, done. But take James Barrett. He and his brother run Rainforest Farms in the Alaskan capital, Juneau. It opened its doors last fall.
We're able to do banking, but we can't put any of our cash sales into that bank account.
Why not?
Because it's drug money.
Drug money is how the federal government views the proceeds from Juneau's first legal marijuana outlet. None of the banks in Juneau or anywhere in Alaska will accept pot money, so his business can't write checks. Rainforest Farms and other pot sellers only accept cash for their product. So Alaska's State Revenue Department set up a cash drop for pot businesses in the largest city, Anchorage. Only there's no road out of Juneau, and Anchorage is more than 500 air miles away.
Revenue said, hey, we set up this P.O. box to receive cash payments. You guys can start using it now. And we're like, that's awesome. Thank you so much, Revenue. That's great.
In mid-April, Barrett dropped a brick of cash into the mail, insured naturally.
About an hour or so after I shipped my payment out, I got a phone call from the post office, and they said, come pick this up. We're not going to send it.
Tacked to the rejected parcel was a printout reminding him of federal law.
Proceeds from marijuana sales are illegal to send through the mail. And that does include tax payments, even though it's legal in the state of Alaska.
That's Jeremy Leader with the U.S. Postal Inspection Service in Seattle, whose jurisdiction includes Alaska.
If you're going to use the United States mail, you have to abide by federal regulations. And marijuana businesses in Alaska sort of have to know that.
That the feds are throwing up roadblocks for state taxpayers isn't just exasperating for marijuana businesses. Alaska's tax director is Ken Alper. His office has been tasked with collecting taxes from the state's marijuana businesses.
It's such a weird in-between world we're in. I mean, this is a licensed business. These guys just spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, gone through a pretty intense regulatory process, state and local, multiple levels. Their whole files are on the internet, it's hundreds of pages of documents. But yet they're operating and they're prevented from doing just the normal things that a business is supposed to be able to do, like use a bank or pay their taxes.
In the end, James Barrett flew to Anchorage and dropped off the cash in person. He admits there may be alternatives. He could set up a shell company, hire a courier, or invent some other workaround. But his point is he shouldn't have to.
We want to do business like regular businesses do. In America, we have a common currency for a reason, just so that all these businesses can work together.
This isn't just a problem in Alaska. Pot businesses in Colorado, Washington, and other states aren't able to bank their earnings. A bill introduced in April in the House by a Colorado Democrat and supported by Alaska's Republican congressman would give banks legal cover to work with marijuana businesses across the country. In the meantime, Alaska's chief taxman, Ken Alper, says the feds ought to recognize the state's right to tax state-licensed businesses.
We don't want a new rule. We want to interpret what's being shipped as something other than the proceeds of a drug transaction. In our view, it is tax money.
Clarity in Washington has been in short supply. Congress's $1 trillion spending bill extends a rule barring the federal government from using any funds to block state marijuana laws. But in a signing statement, President Trump said he reserves the right to ignore it. For Here and Now, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Earlier today, G.T. Bynum, mayor of Tulsa, Oklahoma, spoke about last night's acquittal of white police officer Betty Shelby in the shooting death of the unarmed black man Terrence Crutcher near Crutcher's stalled car. Mayor Bynum said, despite the verdict, the greatest moral issue facing his city is racial disparity.
We have to acknowledge that a divide exists in our city. We can't work to address it until we acknowledge it exists.
Many of the jurors and Terrence Crutcher's family were in tears as the not guilty verdict was read. Here's Terrence's father, Joey Crutcher, afterwards.
I don't know what was in the mind of that jury, how they could come to that conclusion. There was precise evidence that said she was guilty.
Samantha Vicent is courthouse reporter for Tulsa World. Samantha, to remind people, there is dashboard video showing Crutcher's hands were in the air. He was walking away from the officer. The tape caused outrage. Are the jurors saying why they came to their verdict?
We have not heard from a juror yet today. However, the jury sent a note to the judge about 6.5 hours into deliberations asking if they could explain their verdict in open court, to which the judge declined.
Well, and many of the jurors, as we said, were crying. How are you reading that, that they found this a complicated verdict to come to?
The jury did not seem to look at either the Crutcher family or Betty Shelby and her defense counsel as they came in the room. Everybody was very solemn. Several, if not all, the jurors looked like they had cried recently or cried in the courtroom.
Yeah. And the officer, Shelby, had testified that she fired out of fear because she said Crutcher didn't obey her commands to lie on the ground, appeared to reach inside his car for a gun. There was no gun ever found. She was also concerned he was under the influence of PCP. An autopsy showed there was PCP in his system. But how did the fact that we see on that video when other police are there as well, after he was shot, he was not tended to at all. Was that a part of the trial?
It was. The prosecution made a big issue of the fact that Shelby, who was an EMT and still is, did not render aid, and instead another officer who was not a certified EMT rendered aid at least 2 minutes after the shooting occurred.
Look, Tulsa has a long history of troubled race relations. 1921, the race riot that left about 300 black residents dead. In 2015, there was that volunteer, Robert Bates, who shot and killed a black man after Bates, the volunteer, mistook his gun for a taser and actually shot the man instead of tasing him. And now this case. And your new mayor, who wasn't mayor when this happened, Mayor Bynum, issued a statement last night. He appeared today. He seems to be going out of his way to say this verdict doesn't alter a course on which we're set. What's he talking about?
The mayor, during his campaign, has made the disparities in things like life expectancy between Tulsa's black community, which is predominantly in North Tulsa, and the rest of the community, a big issue in his statements. He's pointed out that life expectancy is shorter, that there is mistrust between communities of color and law enforcement. And despite his own affiliation, although our mayoral elections are nonpartisan, he is a bit right-leaning. And he, despite this, has been very affirmative of the fact that there are issues that he sees between police and communities of color and the relationship there.
That's Samantha Vison, courthouse reporter for Tulsa World. Samantha, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, of course, the Black Lives Matter movement was propelled by a police shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, of the unarmed Michael Brown. And one of the most notable photos from the protest that followed was of a young black man with an American flag T-shirt and a bandana over his face, a bag of chips in one hand, his throwing arm drawn back with a burning tear gas canister he was sending back toward police. That was Edward Crawford, who, police say, recently died of a self-inflicted gunshot to the head in the backseat of a friend's car. And he is not the first Black Lives Matter activist to allegedly commit suicide or the first to recently die. The community is reeling. Tremaine Lee is a national reporter for NBCNews.com. He's been covering this cluster of deaths among the Ferguson activists. He joins us by Skype. Tremaine, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us more about what people are thinking. A suicide.
I'll tell you what, the death of Edward Crawford has been another blow to a community that has suffered blow after blow. When you think about this activist community that kind of emerged from that scorched earth of those hot and fiery August days after Michael Brown was killed, they fought with police and politicians, sometimes even with themselves, as they've kind of grown and matured as a movement. But to have the death of Darren Seals, a well-known activist in September, shot dead and found in a burning vehicle. Then you have Edward Crawford, who died of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound, but also activists from across the country, a few who have committed suicide, others who have kind of bared their souls for the movement and dealing with the psychological weight of what that means. So many of these young people, especially, have gone out into the streets. They're not getting paid to do this, to take on the system for what they believe is a movement to better the quality of life for black folks in this country. And so in the wake of Edward Crawford's death, there are so many people, as you mentioned earlier, there are conspiracy theories because they just can't imagine a young man of such promise, whose voice was just kind of coming to being through the protest, that he would kill himself. But then again, you talk to other folks and they'll say that the psychic weight of being part of this movement, of standing up day after day with not much hard to hold on to, right? Mm-hmm. Everything seems tenuous in Ferguson. So they're still grappling with it, and it's hard for a lot of people to reckon with.
Well, and look, that's anecdotal, but there have been a lot of studies recently about the health of young black men in particular, but young blacks. They have an alarming rise in stress-related heart disease that's usually seen in much older people. And one can imagine the stress of seeing, for instance, reports of a 15-year-old shot dead in Dallas for simply leaving a party. I mean, are people saying that perhaps in standing up to recognize some of these inequities, these young men may be feeling them more?
You know, after Michael Brown was killed and we saw hundreds and thousands of protesters coming into the streets in Ferguson, the vast, vast majority of those folks had no experience in activism or politics at all. These were everyday people who watched Michael Brown's body bake in the sun for 4 hours. And so when you think about these young people arriving at that moment, angry, upset, ready to take on the police and the world for that matter, many of them brought their whole self to that moment. And we wrestle with this idea of post-traumatic stress disorder. There's a trauma surgeon named Selwyn Rogers in Chicago. He says they're going through present traumatic syndrome. It doesn't ever end. You know, it's not like something happened and you're recovering. You're always in this constant state of trauma. When you think about what the exposure to violence does to a person, it actually rewires your brain. The cortisol levels go off the charts. So imagine when you see, you know, your garden variety urban gun violence, then you see violence at the hands of police, then you have the abstract violence of hunger and poverty and lack of access to quality health care and education. All of this is weighing on the hearts and minds of so many young black people in particular, the least of which is dealing with the stresses from a system that often grinds us up.
Well, look, we also rush to say that some of these cases could be a mental health issue that then collided with activism. You've got Marshawn McCarroll, 23. He shot and killed himself on the steps of the State House of Columbus, Ohio. Hours earlier, he had posted to his Facebook, "My demons won today. I'm sorry." So, you know, we don't know, you know, exactly what this is. And some of the other deaths you mentioned, bodies found in burning cars, could be, you know, crime. But there certainly does seem to be something going on. And either way, it can't help but add another layer of stress to the one that you just mentioned. We understand that a lot of people who are in the Black Lives Matter movement are adding self-care to their mission?
It's been amazing over the last few years. I've talked to so many young activists in Ferguson and organizers. That idea of self-care, of safe spaces, of taking time for yourself, it's prominent. But for so many others, there's this sense of urgency that if they don't act now, if they don't keep their foot on the pedal, then the change that they've been hoping for won't come to fruition. And so with all the pressure and everything weighing on so many of these young people, they're self-aware enough, at least many of them, that sometimes they need to sit down, they need to relax, they need to breathe while they're trying to change the world.
You write they're providing resources for suicide prevention organizations on social media. And look, Edward Crawford's father, Edward Crawford Sr., told the St. Louis Dispatch, "I don't believe it was a suicide. Again, a gunshot wound to the head in the back seat of the car his friends were driving. There are witnesses, you know, the friends that were in the car. But is there any sense he was a father of four, any sense that there, you know, might have been gangs or drugs involved?"
At this point, you know, there are still a few more questions than there are answers. And I think we're operating in this environment in Ferguson and Chicago and Baltimore and cities across the country where there simply is no trust in the system, not the police, not the investigators, not the media sometimes and in the way we frame our stories. And so in this space where there is so little trust, people often will fill in the blanks. In Ferguson especially, you know, conspiracy theories abound. Mm-hmm. But I think one thing is clear is that there is a dark cloud hanging over that city. And as much as they fight and try to clear the way for some sunshine, bad things continue to happen in that city.
Yeah. Trymaine Lee, he's a national reporter for NBCNews.com. Trymaine, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you everything you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste, and it's delivered right to your door. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying seasonally inspired recipes and exploring new flavors and cuisines. No commitment. Get the meals only when you want. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
For the third year in a row, the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Golden State Warriors are marching toward the NBA Finals. LeBron James and the Cavs easily won the first game of the Eastern Conference Finals yesterday against the Boston Celtics. And in the West, the Warriors lead the San Antonio Spurs 2-0 in the best-of-seven series. Joining us now is Here and Now sports analyst Mike Pesca, who hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
So last night we had game one of the Eastern Conference Championships between the Celtics and the Cavs. The Celtics coming off an exciting game seven win on Monday against the Wizards. The Cavs had more than a week of rest, and I don't say that because I'm saying that that was why they won. Just stating the facts, Mike, but how dominant was LeBron and his team?
Oh, he was extremely dominant. He said that he wasn't feeling 100% and still scored almost 40 points. And when you say that the Cavs and the Warriors are marching to or through the NBA playoffs, they really are in the William Tecumseh Sherman sense because they haven't lost. The Warriors were down in game one of their series and mounted. They were down by over 20 at halftime, mounted a huge comeback. And the Cavaliers, so let's not be cavalier about it. The Cavaliers are a great team, but they're bad defensively. I mean, they're just really a sub-average defensive team, except, well, that's how they've been this year, at least. You wouldn't know it from how they played against the Celtics. And yes, Isaiah Thomas and the Celtics do sometimes run cold, and then they have no chance of winning. But my God, they put the screws onto the Celtics players. And there you have Thomas. And here's a guy who's a 91% foul shooter, clanking both ends of free throw tries. It was the Celtics were down by 22 at halftime. This was a game that you could feel confident, even though the final score was 13. This was a game that you could feel confident tuning out of midway through the second quarter.
But just game one, so we'll see what happens in the rest of the series. But yes, the Cavs were very impressive.
It did not augur well for games right. two through, I'm going to say, four.
Well, let's see. What about in the Western Conference Championships? Game three for them is on Saturday. It's a matchup between the Golden State Warriors and the San Antonio Spurs. So far, the Warriors have won two games. What do you expect there?
The biggest question is Kawhi Leonard's health. He had an ankle injury that was re-aggravated in a couple different ways in game one, tripping over his own player, own teammate, tripping over a Warriors player, Zaza. Without Leonard, the Spurs don't have enough offense, period, full stop. And we should also note that the Warriors have more offense than any team in the history of this league, almost too much offense. So, you know, this seems like maybe there can be some Greg Popovich Spurs magic if they were at full health. Barring that, looks like we're headed to a rematch of the finals.
And meanwhile, just briefly, Mike, the Stanley Cup finals in hockey are also happening right now, which some people are saying are even more exciting than the NBA playoffs.
Well, yes, because it's not as if two teams have been decimating everyone. So in the East, Ottawa is ahead of Pittsburgh. The Penguins have scored one goal in every game of all three games of that series. They're down 2-1. And then you have the Predators of Nashville over the Ducks. A Predator should be beating a Duck just based on nicknames. Can you imagine the NHL getting a Nashville against Ottawa finals? What a boon for ratings that would be for them.
That's Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Will his many swirling controversies dog President Trump like a cyclone as he heads off on his first presidential trip abroad, first to Saudi Arabia and Israel, then the Vatican and a NATO meeting in Brussels? There was the firing of FBI head James Comey, reports that the president leaked intelligence from Israel to Russia, claims that the president asked Comey to stop an investigation into Russian ties, and that dust-up over the Western Wall in Jerusalem, one of the holiest sites in Judaism, adjacent to one of the most important mosques in the Muslim world. It has always been a political minefield, and this week the Trump administration hit tripwire after tripwire. Aaron David Miller is a distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served as a Mideast negotiator in Democratic and Republican administrations and joins us by Skype. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
You know, the trip's coming later than most presidents do make this kind of trip, and we're reading accounts in the New York Times, for instance, that, you know, President Trump is something of a homebody, as they put it. He's not that eager to travel abroad. But before the controversies this week, what was the hope that this trip would do?
I mean, I think the hope was that you have a president who, unlike his predecessors, has waited. Obama, I think, took 9 trips in his first 100 days to make his entry in the world stage, and now has a trip which is really quite dramatic, filled with extraordinarily tough but high-minded issues: Israelis, Palestinians, Muslims, Saudis, the Pope, the G7, NATO, that somehow this would be an opportunity for the president to shine on the world stage, to strut on the world stage, as presidents like to do, particularly when their domestic agendas become complex, or in this case, when in fact you have a presidency that is much weakened, defensive, and embroiled in potential scandal. And you'd wonder why any president would seek any sort of remedy from domestic travails by plunging into the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Mm. I think his first two stops, though, in Saudi Arabia and Israel could potentially be productive, or at least he's expecting, and I think he will receive, despite all the controversy, warm receptions in each, and there are reasons for that.
Well, let's talk about Saudi Arabia first, the first stop. During the campaign, the candidate Trump complained that the U.S. backed the kingdom at tremendous expense. He told Reuters recently that Saudi Arabia has not treated us fairly because we're losing a tremendous amount of money in defending Saudi Arabia. And then, of course, there are also his travel bans. They don't include Saudi Arabia, but they include Muslims. It is a Muslim country. And previous statements about Islam. So it sounds like there's tension there, but you say what?
Yeah, there are certainly a lot of complexities. But as with many things in foreign policy, the positions adopted on the campaign trail by candidate and then nominee Donald Trump have given way to the more sober and cruel realities of governing. You have a president now who, number one, is about to conclude an arms sale with the Saudis that will probably be larger than any other in the history of the relationship. Mm. You have a president who is counting and banking heavily on the Saudis in order to use the Saudis and the Gulf states in order to facilitate Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking. And you have a Saudi government that I think, in the wake of Mr. Trump's predecessor, And the Iranian nuclear agreement is eager to capitalize and exploit Mr. Trump's toughening position on the one national security issue that the Saudis care most about, which is Iran, Iran, and Iran. Right. So I think the Saudis have a real stake in making going over the top on this visit. And remember, he's going to meet with the king and members of the Saudi royal family, and he's also going to see a collection of Muslim leaders from around the region where he is reportedly going to give his speech on Islam.
Well, let me ask you about that, because it's been described as perhaps a counter to President Obama's speech in 2009 in Cairo, in which he reached out to the Muslim community and said, we're going to have a new relationship. Would Donald Trump really try to counter that while in a Muslim country? What's he expected to say?
I wouldn't, given the spontaneous and ad hoc nature of Mr. Trump's tweets and statements, even want to begin to speculate on what the president will say. I mean, is he going to use his famous phrase, radical Islamic terrorism, a phrase which his own national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, has tried to get him not to use? Is he going to include too many generalizations when it comes to who Muslims are and what they should do? I don't know. I think the notion of a three-world religion tour, which is essentially what Mr. Trump is doing. He's seen Muslims in Saudi Arabia, Jews in Israel, and Catholics and Christians, of course, at the Vatican, would impel and compel him to make sure that this speech really didn't include any stumbles or howlers.
Well, you mentioned General McMaster, and the other huge controversy this past week or so has been what to call the Western Wall, which is in Jerusalem, is, as we said, one of the most sacred sites in Judaism, is a landmine, as we said. There are reports on Israeli television that an American official involved in planning this visit had turned down a request by Prime Minister Netanyahu to join President Trump when he visits the wall. Now, as we said, no sitting president has ever visited. Civilian presidents have, among them Obama and Bush. And no prime minister has ever appeared, certainly with an official at the wall. Remind us, first of all, why this is so delicate, why U.S. policy has been to say that this wall is in Jerusalem, not in Israel.
It's not just the Western Wall, which is actually the retaining wall of the temple destroyed by the Romans in 70 CE.
Which now has a mosque on that property.
Well, two mosques on the noble enclosure, the Haram Sharif on top, and then remains of the two Jewish temples underneath. It's overlapping sacred space and is among the most controversial, volatile, and emotional issues among the panoply of issues in negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. And that is, in fact, the reason why successive administrations, despite campaign promises of candidates, which Mr. Trump has also made, most American presidents in office have realized that if they want to have any chance of, in this case, reinvigorating a now comatose peace process, that you do not take the single most volatile and emotional issue and play around with it.
And let's further remind people that the American policy is to treat East Jerusalem, where the wall is, as Israeli-occupied territory because it was seized by Israeli troops in 1967, and it's disputed. Both the Palestinians and the Israelis claim this East Jerusalem as their capital. So it's been U.S. policy to say it is in Jerusalem. It's not Israel's. And there was an attempt to make McMaster call it the wall in Israel. But also, Nikki Haley did do that. Of course, she's the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Let's hear what she said on the Christian Broadcasting Network show, The Brody File.
You know, I don't know what the policy of the administration is, but I believe the Western Wall is part of Israel. And I think that that's how, you know, we've always seen it, and that's how we should pursue it. I'm not real sure what happened with that issue, but I know that they're trying to fix that and get that taken care of. But, you know, we've always thought that the Western Wall was part of Israel.
Aaron David Miller, as I just said, the U.S. policy is that it is not.
Well, look, you'd have to go back to the Bush 41 administration, I think, to see an American official on the record talk about East Jerusalem as occupied territory. That may, in fact, be the de facto position the U.S. takes, but does not talk about that. In fact, the reality is most administrations choose not to talk about Jerusalem at all. I think this administration, unlike all of its predecessors, has not only promised to move the U.S. embassy and I think made a few stumbles on Jerusalem. They basically have in many respects, tried to course correct, but they still are now in a position where much of the focal point of the president's trip may be on Jerusalem, and it may well be that in response to growing pressure and their own self-inflicted wounds and the issue of the Israeli intelligence issue with the Russians, it's certainly possible that the president may feel compelled to make some statement with respect to not to moving the embassy, but to acknowledging the fact that however negotiations ultimately resolve themselves, it is my view, he would speak personally, that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. It would not surprise me if such a statement was made. And it shows, to me at least, the danger and the volatility of the Jerusalem issue.
Are you nervous about President Trump's trip to the Middle East?
Am I nervous? I'm not going. I'm not planning. I'm not working for President Trump. No, I'm not nervous. I think by and large, the trip, given the travails that he faces at home, couldn't be any more hostile or complicated, frankly, than the environment that this president faces right now.
Aaron David Miller, distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Aaron, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Let's talk asparagus with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Guntz, who is in the studio with me. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jeremy.
And asparagus is one of those things that you can cook in a lot of different ways.
It's very adaptable, although I will say that if you've ever been to a friend's garden or grown them yourself or gone to a pick-your-own asparagus farm, which exists all over the country, there's nothing like them when they're so fresh. You can eat them raw. You can steam them. You can roast them. You can grill them. You can stir-fry them. You name a cooking method, and you can do it. But this time of year, we're well into the season now. They are delicious, very thin. Thinly sliced raw or just steamed with a touch of butter and some good salt. And it's just such a seasonal treat.
I learned something about asparagus the other day, which was how long you can keep it. It's not very long after you get it from the market.
Right. Well, let's talk about that. When you get it from the market, and hopefully it's a farmer's market or somewhere where they really are locally sourced, first thing you should do is take a look at the bottom of the asparagus, because you know how sometimes they look really dry and shriveled? Mm. That means they're old. It means they've been out of the ground, the moisture's out of them, they're drying up, move on. You want to look for a bright green, and you want to look for the ends that don't seem super dried out. And you don't want to wash them until you're using them. This is another thing people do. They bring their produce home and they wash it immediately. Keeping some of that dirt on and some of that grit keeps it fresher longer. Most people feel that they're okay in the refrigerator for a few days, meaning maybe four at the most.
Okay. All right. Well, let's see what you've done with asparagus here, starting with this dish that we've got in front of us. And we'll have pictures and recipes at hereandnow.org. This has a fried egg on top of it.
It does. So what I did was I took some seasonal asparagus and I just steamed them until – oh, so this is the other thing. People overcook asparagus. I like them to have a little bit of bite, what the Italians call al dente with pasta. Yum. So you trim the end, you steam it, and then I melted some butter and let it get brown and fried the egg in it and put it right on top of that asparagus, cut into that and let the yolk kind of ooze. And then there's some brown slivered almonds. You could use pistachios. Pistachios or hazelnuts and lemon juice and a little bit of olive oil. And it's kind of like breakfast, lunch, or dinner.
Well, I was going to say, is this for breakfast? Is this a breakfast meal?
You tell me.
I think it could be.
I'm wide open,
pretty healthy.
Jeremy.
Yeah.
So that's one take. Very healthy, very simple. The brown butter might put it over a little bit, but it gives it a richness that's so delicious.
Yeah.
Asparagus traditionally are served with hard-boiled chopped eggs, and this was my take on it, an over-easy, quick-fry egg.
All right. The next dish you've got here is a risotto with
risotto.
Asparagus.
So risotto, you use arborio rice. It's a rice that soaks up liquid very evenly and steadily, and I used every part of the asparagus for this. So you trim off the ends. I brought a few in here. I want to show you. You take a whole of an asparagus spear, and if you just snap, the tough end will come off. See here? Mm. It's just, people say, well, where do I trim it? It will come off naturally. So I took the tough ends and I put them into a vegetable stock or a chicken stock, along with some of the tough part of a leek, and simmered that up. So my stock gets to have an asparagus flavor. Then I sauteed some leek and garlic. I added the rice. I added some fresh dill and lemon zest.
I love that dill too. Yeah,
yeah,
the
you
lemon
taste
zest.
The lemon. It's just all about late spring, early summer flavors that wake you up. Then I added the middle part of the asparagus cooked into the risotto. and I use the delicate spears as a garnish on top. So you've got raw, cooked, and flavored broth. Mm. No waste.
What's your favorite of those three?
This time of year, there's nothing like eating a raw asparagus straight out of the ground. It's so tender and delicious. But I love doing all kinds of things. As you can see, I made one more dish.
Yes, and this is a tart. This looks amazing.
This is a tart. So I did not make this puff pastry, though I could have, but I figured most people don't want to quit their day job to make puff pastry. So this is frozen puff pastry that you can find all over. And I rolled it out into a rectangle. I roasted these asparagus first, and then I just whipped up a few eggs with some goat cheese and put them into the pastry, and there you have this beautiful, really puffy, golden brown pastry. The roasting brings out a whole other flavor in the asparagus.
That's delicious, and for a frozen puff pastry, not bad.
Not bad, huh?
Not bad.
Yeah, and I didn't take – all you have to do is thaw it in the refrigerator. That's the trick with it.
Now, this is asparagus season that we're in right now. How much of the year can you have good, fresh asparagus?
Generally, you'll find them through June. It depends what part of the country you live in. In Europe, you'll see white asparagus in the spring and the summer, which are considered a real delicacy. They're generally a lot sweeter than the green asparagus, which people say tastes like a grassy flavor, an earthy flavor. There are also purple asparagus coming onto the market. They're very pretty, but they tend to be expensive, so not quite worth it. But again, I would say the most important thing this time of year is to try to find a farmer who's growing it or a market that sells asparagus that have not been flown across the country.
And I should point out that at some point later today, I am going to be reminded that I did this segment.
Well, possibly.
The thing about asparagus, you're like, oh, yeah, I did have asparagus.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of true. So why don't you tell them
we'll
what we're talking
it.
About?
No, let's just leave it right
let's
there.
Let's just say number one.
Kathy Gunst, Here and Now resident chef, and we will put the recipes at hereandnow.org. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
What? We're number one? What? I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.